Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
And I'm John.
And with us is one of our favorites, just because he always brings it.
Hard. Like, both, he just goes hard every time.
Hard story. Like, you are a shit magnet, James.
Oh, yeah. Shit magnet life.
100%. You are 100% a shit magnet. So thanks for being back, and you're here because for those of you who aren't subscribers, we are recording our War Stories Tiger King episode for subscribers only. Because let me just tell you, the more we got into it, the more we watched it, the more we realized we have to discuss that thing. And
that was just a white trash shit show.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. It's like a traffic accident. We have, for those of you who are familiar with JR. John, why don't you tell them kind of how this all came down with JR?
Yeah, so JR had hit us up about a gentleman that he knew via. Do you guys? I don't know if you guys know each other personally or just through social media.
Lauren? Just through the gram.
Just through the gram. Okay, so Lauren and JR know each other through the gram, and then JR hit us up and said, "Hey, you should reach out to this guy. He's legit. Talk to him and see if he wants to come on the show." Type of thing. Lauren has been a follower of us and listener. So we did, we touched base, and now he's our guest on our show.
So excited. Glad to be here.
Yeah. We're glad you made the time out to talk to us.
Yeah, thanks. And why don't you, why don't you just start by telling us a little bit about yourself and your career in law enforcement? Cause you are, a police officer in the South, right? Whose agency shall remain nameless.
the mystery agency.
Exactly.
So yeah, I'm in Georgia. Don't have a problem saying that. Born and raised here. Been in law enforcement a little over 8 years. So I know compared to some of your guests and some of you guys still on the newer side, but, been in law enforcement a little over 8 years. So growing up, my mom's brother was a policeman. And so I had that influence early on. And then my mom's dad was a fireman. So I knew it was kind of going to be one of the two. And kind of the stereotypical thing, you know, always playing cops and robbers as a kid and wanting to be the cop and, you know, going to the stores and wanting to get the police, you know, costumes and whatnot. So from an early age, I had that influence. And, at about, I think it was 18, I found the Explorer program through a local sheriff's office here, in North Georgia. And it was one of those things where I was kind of intimidated, you know, like should I do this? But I did it, and it started to fit like a glove. You know, I loved everything about it. You know, had to cut my hair short. You know, I used to have long hair, so like cutting my hair short was a big deal. And so I really kind of just, it fit like a glove. And so I started doing ride-alongs with the sheriff's office and made some really good friends that I'm still friends with now. And so that was kind of my introduction into law enforcement, really being able to see what it was like was through the Explorer program. And, you know, I owe a lot to that program. And I know you guys have had some guests who are also a part of that. And mm-hmm. So it's definitely an important thing.
Yeah, I was an Explorer post advisor. That was kind of your intro to special assignments was if they liked you and they thought you might be good at special assignments, they tapped you to be an Explorer advisor. Because that was to see your level of dedication and commitment right. And all that. And then if you proved yourself in that program, they would look at you for other things. So it was great. It was great. Nice.
Yeah, I was an Explorer for LASD when I was 16 in high school. And, you know, it was cool. We went over to the different big prisons and, you know, we got pepperballed and maced and tased and the whole nine yards.
They did that to you at 12 years old?
I was 16.
I'm just kidding. I'm fine.
I would have done it to him as well.
I know.
You know,
now wasn't I listening to one of your shows where someone was saying their Explorer post went international?
My father. Okay. So okay. My father was an Explorer, and when he was with, he was the LAPD Explorer, and he had an Explorer post advisor that was just like, he was tapped into all the things and the, you know, like, you ever know the guy, it's like the guy in prison that could get you anything. Mm-hmm. You know, this was the cop that just knew where all the money was hidden. And he somehow managed to finagle a trip to Japan and a trip to Europe or Germany.
Awesome.
Yeah,
nice. Wow. So legit.
That was a good podcast.
That's never going to happen again, but you know. It was like 1964.
I was listening to that and I was, that's, what an opportunity. That's awesome.
Right.
But I think the farthest we went was, there was some competitions in like Gatlinburg. And so we went there.
Yeah, we went to a competition that was about 20 minutes north of our station.
I was going to say, I think the farthest our explorers ever went was maybe in the LAPD helicopter and then up.
Hey, you know what?
And that was about it.
That's something. I mean, yeah. I know a lot of people have never ridden a helicopter.
That's true.
So young people out there, if you want to ride in a helicopter, go join the explorers.
There you go.
Join the explorers, but for real, if there is anybody listening who's curious about law enforcement, the Explorer program is awesome.
Yeah, it's like Boy Scouts but with balls.
exactly.
All right. So,
yes. So, did Explorer program, really decided, hey, this is what I want to do. So did that maybe till I was 20, and I didn't really want to be like a jailer or work in the jail. And so,
good for you.
Yeah, you know, I know a lot of guys that did, and now they're on the road, and they're, you know, they're great because of that experience. But you know, it was just something I didn't want to do at the time. And so I went to I got on with a corporate security. It was CNN and Turner Broadcasting at the time. And so I got on, did corporate security with them, got some firearms, you know, hands on, and was kind of, you know, just getting towards it. And at the time, it's kind of hard to believe now, but no one was hiring in law enforcement. Mm. I mean, nobody, you know, being an explorer for the agency I was doing it with, I was on, you know, the short wait list, for when they started hiring, but it was, you know, no one was hiring.
What was the age out for your, agency for the explorers? Was it 21?
21. Yeah.
Okay. And that's usually because that's the age at which they expect you to
join,
go to the academy. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the age where they're like, okay, if you're going to do it, let's do it.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, you know, no one was hiring. And I remember I put in with a local city PD and went through pretty much almost all of the hiring process. And I sat down with the chief and he was like, well, you know, the good news is, he's like, I got no issues with you. You know, you seem like a good candidate, be a good fit. I'm like, okay, what's the issue? He goes, you know, I got two other guys that are already certified. I just got to put, you know, a uniform on them. They can throw it tomorrow. Whereas you guys need academy.
Yep.
So after consulting with some friends, I decided to do pre-service. So I sent myself through an academy here in Georgia.
And, that's what I did.
There you go. Hey, and it makes you a good candidate afterwards.
Yeah.
Because as you all know, if an agency doesn't have to spend a few grand sending you to the academy, you know, you're golden.
Yeah, especially if you live in an area where it's smaller agencies. You know, they don't have the resources. They don't have their own academy like LA Sheriff or LAPD or NYPD or some of those bigger agencies. A lot of smaller agencies have to do these regional academies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a couple in California I can think of that are pretty famous off the top of my head. But you go in, you prove yourself there. It's like trade school. And then a lot of times the local agencies will come down and talk to the director of the academy, the TAC officers, the DIs, all that stuff, to just to find out who's squared away and who's not. And that alone can get you your foot further in the door than just walking in Joe Schmo off the street asking for a badge and a gun.
That's legit. When I lived in Texas, I lived in a county that had two deputies patrolling an 80-mile square radius. And like whenever, you know, there'd be a bar fight or anything like that, they'd show up and they'd be like, everybody's on a first name basis. Yep. They'd be like, hey, what the hell's going on? Stuff like that.
That's community-oriented policing right there.
That explains how those guys got that job. So,
well, no. So there's some agencies where legitimately, like I worked with a dude who was a cop in Ohio before he came to California, and he was allowed to be on the street for 6 or 8 months before he went to the academy.
Holy shit.
Yeah. There are some agencies where they put you in a training car. and they'll start teaching you on the job training.
Feet to the fire type training.
And then, oh, there's an academy opening up. We're going to send you. That to me is bananas.
That's good.
So you put yourself through.
Yeah. So I put myself through. And like you said, here in Georgia, it was a regional academy. And the cool thing was, and still is, kind of full circle, I now teach at that academy.
Nice.
But but at the time and still, so they would bring, there wasn't like just one instructor. They would bring in an instructor almost for every different class.
Right. That's what they
from
did.
Just the local agencies.
Yep.
So not only were you getting kind of a variety of instruction and experience, but they would also be coming in there and saying, oh, you know, there's two pre-service guys in this class. Okay, let's talk to them a little more. And that's what happened with me. You know, 21 years old, I would have been a police officer anywhere, you know?
Right.
And so an agency came in. I remember a sergeant came in and was teaching us maybe like patrol tactics or something kind of, you know, interesting. And he was pretty sharp, was a Marine Corps veteran. I remember he was really, really sharp. So we started talking, and the agency he worked for was basically about halfway from Atlanta to Alabama. Probably a little bit more than halfway. So it was only about 20 minutes from the Alabama line. And I'm from the kind of North Georgia area, not from West Georgia. And this agency probably had 30 sworn at the time. You know, it paid $13 an hour at the time.
Oh, and, wow.
That's worse than I made as an EMT in LA, man.
Well, I bet you the EMTs there got paid even worse than that.
Yep, probably.
Wow. Yeah, seriously.
How's Georgia on income tax?
Yeah, right?
Not okay. Exactly.
So you get hired by a small agency then.
Yeah, so I went and sat down. I got hired by the super small agency and, you know, went to the FTO process. And it was a bunch of really good guys. It was super rural. You know, I was driving like 80 miles round trip, you know, to and from work. But, you know, I did about a year out there. It was just a mixture of the money and being in a place that honestly I didn't enjoy. It was just far from home. But I got some good experience, and I left that agency and came to my current department, which is a little closer to the city, you know, where I was familiar with, bigger agency, bigger budget, more opportunities. So anyways, came to my current agency, worked patrol for a while, you know, as anyone would do, worked the night shift. We have at the time we had kind of a joint car between us and a bigger agency next to us that was basically robbery suppression. So I kind of got my feet wet, you know, getting more exposure to some inner city calls and whatnot. Nice. And then it was a lot of fun. And I had always kind of said, you know, they asked me in the academy, you know, what do you think your career is going to be? And I was like, oh, you know, drug interdiction, you know, DUI, really kind of in the weeds, you know, tactical stuff. And I was able to experience a lot of that, but the word got out in the department that I was big on social media personally. And I remember the captain came to me and he said, hey, we're going to start a new program. It's going to be a social media coordinator, you know, in community outreach. You know, I hear that you are into social media. So I interviewed for that position and I started up my agency's first, it was really our first PIO in social media.
Yeah. When the chief comes to you and says, are you interested?
you don't say no.
That's cool though, because I think some of the best Twitter spats I've ever seen are between police agencies and civilians.
Oh no, I've seen some of my favorites are like Facebook posts or Twitter posts between a police agency and some shithead with a warrant.
Oh yeah, and they are they like it?
Yeah, yeah,
or whatever. Anyway, yeah.
Wait a second. Who are you? So I kind of got started on that, and you know, developed policy, and you know, we won some awards, and so really started up this social media program. And within that, which kind of leads me to what I'm doing now, is we would at the time we were using a company called Geofedia. I don't know if you're familiar or not, but it would monitor publicly available social media posts. And so we could use it not only for content creation ideas, but also you know, situational awareness and big events and crisis and whatnot. So that led me into what I do now, which is social media investigations and threat assessment. In our criminal investigations division, I'm a detective there, and I specialize in threat assessments and anything online.
Nice. So you get those little shitheads who threaten schools.
Yeah,
and stuff
you found
like that.
You found the niche that is bursting onto the scene, which is kind of, you know, when the telephone was becoming a thing, then it was you know, annoying and harassing phone calls and crimes over the phone. Somebody had to investigate those for the first time. And
exactly.
So now you're doing For the modern social.
That's
era.
Great, man. Yeah. That is like great. I've never met anybody who does that.
No, me neither.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Because you know, these little shithead keyboard warriors get a big head.
Yes.
And then they go after people and they say some stupid shit and they need to be held accountable.
Well,
yeah, for sure. Or at least try to be held accountable, right?
Yeah. Well, at the very least, you can throw some shade their way and scare them away from it.
Or you can show up in person and make them put up or shut up.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like you said, since it's like a new thing, you know, it encompasses so much. And, you know, so I'll work large scale events. You know, we have a lot of critical infrastructure and large sporting events in my jurisdiction. And I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to be assigned over to the FBI for the Super Bowl that was in Atlanta a couple years ago. It was awesome.
That had to be wild.
So because of your job, you got loaned to an Atlanta area task force run by the FBI. And you were based, so it's like when I was working NARCS for the state of Cal, I didn't work for the state of California. I worked for my agency, but I got loaned to this task force. So you get loaned out by your agency to a task force that was stood up by the FBI for the Super Bowl.
For the Super Bowl. Yeah. And I didn't really realize any of this until it happened, but so Atlanta police, they were responsible for every aspect of securing the Super Bowl, except for one thing. And that was the intelligence, and the intelligence was being handled by the FBI.
So you got the show, the Alphabet Boys. What was up?
Exactly.
Yes. So we went up to the FBI headquarters here and, you know, huge conference room and you name it, they were in there. And then you had some others that you never heard of. It was quite insane. And I remember the thing that I remember most about that first day, they briefed us all. The FBI guys up there throwing out these acronyms. And I thought I was pretty well versed in law enforcement acronyms. And he's throwing out all this stuff, and I was taking notes. And afterwards, I went up to one of the special agents, and I was like, hey, you got to explain to me what all this stands for, man, because I have no idea. So we went through a list of about 20 acronyms that stood for you know, their different stuff they did. But so that's, you know, that was one thing that my job kind of, you know, affords me. And then another really rewarding part about it is we'll have somebody in crisis, whether it's a student or a citizen, and they'll post to social media, you know, I'm depressed, I'm suicidal, I'm going to go jump off this building. And so I specialize in reaching out to that social media company and getting an IP address and then tracking that IP address down.
Right.
And there's been quite a few instances where, you know, we show up at a house or a room or what have you and knock on the door and see the person sitting there at the computer and able to get them help.
That's fucking amazing.
So it's really cool.
You know, it's interesting because when I was working NARCS, MySpace was a thing, right? That was new, MySpace, right?
Okay, so you're old as shit.
So we were wondering, like, we would make fake MySpace accounts that were, you know, our law enforcement accounts, so we could fish, you know, in people's photos and stuff. And I remember we wrote a warrant based off of a post some dude, you know, made of, he had photos of pills and a post saying, anybody wants some, you know, they called it Thizz at that time, it was ecstasy. He's like, anybody wants some, hit me up. And he posts pictures of pills. And I'm like,
wow,
cool. I'm going to get that IP address. I'm going to write that warrant.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Shit, man. I wish I had you around when I was in the Army, when I lost a few friends. I've got a couple tattoos on my back for friends that I lost from that shit.
Yeah.
And
so that's cool.
You know, your job is extraordinarily important.
Well, especially in the days of active shooters and school shootings that, here's the thing. I'm going to digress for just a minute and I'm going to say that we have a school shooter, active shooter problem only in the sense that in the 60s and 70s and 80s, we had a serial killer problem, right? So you don't have the Ted Bundys and the John Wayne Gacy's. I mean, you still do, don't get me wrong, but you know, the 60s, 70s and 80s were kind of this golden age for serial killers where they were sensationalized and everybody was talking about them and oh my gosh. But like you had a serial killer that was running around LA for 20 years and the cops didn't say shit. And then he finally just recently, they caught him in the 2000s and then he died in prison only recently.
Was that the Golden State?
The Grim
State?
Sleeper.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
The Golden State Killer, same, you know, same kind of thing. So in this day and age, when these school shooting things, and I don't want to say it's prevalent because I think my personal thing is that it has become a way to get attention. It is like the way being a serial killer was, where being a serial killer was a way to make a name for yourself, and you were homicidal to begin with. You just decided to use that method. Now you have these young people, or even these adults who they're willing to kill people to make a name for themselves and air out their grievance, or even if they don't have a grievance, just be a psychopath. So now, because of things like Columbine and whatnot, it has become almost trendy or in vogue in the last 2 decades. And I think that, and then the media plays, you know, an important role in hyping that up and, you know, making it salacious.
Yeah.
So in that era, having a job where you can monitor social media and monitor the kids that are posting, you know, nobody better go to school tomorrow. If you stay home sick, you're going to be lucky because I'm going to come tomorrow and I'm mad. And then they post a picture of, like, you know, their dad's, you know, 1911 from freaking desert, you know, it would, Korea, or I don't know what heirloom weapons you have nowadays, but
who knows?
My point is that they post all these damn pictures.
I think the lack of community and, like, lack of...
Yeah, they're running their mouth. Yeah. No, they're just running their mouth. Mm-hmm. And your job, sounds like, is to go see these people in person. And if they're running their mouth, maybe intervene and get them a little bit of counseling, a little bit of help, put them on the right path. And if they're not running their mouth, you know, give them a night in the Gray Bar Motel and figure out, you know, what to do with them from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of twofold. One, it's, you know, if we can, to identify and then, you know, make contact with the person, whether it be, you know, on the phone or bringing them for an interview, depending on where they're at. But then the other aspect of it is, you know, if we have that threat, you know, that threat assessment is going to be more than, you know, me just saying, yeah, you know, this seems credible or it doesn't. You know, we have an objective,
right,
a whole system that we process, that we go through, that we just, you know, bore you guys to death. But we just go through it so systematically, and we're able to determine, you know, what kind of level of threat there is.
Well, but you think about it, in the early days of criminal profiling, right, behavioral science.
Sure.
When they're looking through and they're going through and they're classifying behaviors and they're deciding, you know, where, if you're looking at bedwetting, or if you're looking at torturing animals, or you're looking at starting fires, or you're looking at behaviors as a youngster, and then you're looking at, you know, indicators in your adulthood, you have to establish criteria. So it sounds like you guys have gotten to a place where you can sort of establish a guideline and criteria and do the science and do the research and figure out, how do we determine legitimacy versus, you know, bullshit?
Yep.
So, well, that's great.
Exactly.
Well, it sounds like you've got a really cool, interesting new job. And it's interesting that you met JR through social media, and that's kind of your thing. That's your wheelhouse. And so we appreciate him bringing you to us. And floor is yours, man. What's your story?
Awesome. So, like I mentioned earlier, you know, growing up, my uncle, my mom's brother was an Atlanta police officer. And my grandfather was a fireman. And as far as I knew, that was all the law enforcement or public safety that was in, you know, in my family. So I was probably 2 years into being a cop. And you know, as much as a part of my life as this story is, and you'll see, I don't remember exactly how I found out about it. But I remember I was going through the Officer Down Memorial page, and for Atlanta Police, in May of 1902, there was a fallen officer by the name of Ed Crabtree. And I started looking at this officer and was able to quickly see that he was my great, great, great uncle. And he was shot. All I knew at the time is that he was shot and killed in the line of duty on May 17th of 1902. So that obviously, you know, got my attention, and I reached out to my grandfather. He's almost 85, and it was on his side of the family. I reached out to him. I'm like, do you know anything about this? He's like, you know, not a clue. But I was able to, you know, go through the family tree and confirm that sure enough, this is my three great, my great uncle. So what this has been probably, of course, we got the dogs barking now, but this has been probably 4 years in the making of research. And my goal is to write a book. The dogs are freaking out.
No, it's okay.
So my goal through all this is to write a book. And it initially was going to be the story of my uncle and his death, And then the more that I researched it, the more that I found that there were, you know, all these officers killed in line of duty for the Atlanta Police Department between around 1890 and 1910, they were virtually forgotten. One of the things I do is I like to kind of an amateur historian, and I like, you know, old cemeteries, especially kind of Victorian cemeteries. And so we'll go out and we'll find these fallen Atlanta police officers, and all of them are literally just covered up in grass and shrubs and trees.
So to your, and to your knowledge, as far as the Atlanta Police Department knows, if you know, they don't hold themselves any type of memorial at a headquarters or anything like that for these fallen officers, or
yes and no. So All right, so let me explain that, because I know some Atlanta police officers are probably gonna be listening. At Atlanta police headquarters, when you walk in, there's a wall of honor, and it has they have a public safety headquarters. So fire and law enforcement are based out of this building. Mm-hmm. On one side where the fire is, they have a plaque on the wall for every fireman that has been killed in line of duty. And then over on the police side, they have the same thing. So they have a current day shield of the Atlanta Police Department with the officer's name and when they died on the wall. So they have all of that recorded.
Okay.
And then every year they have a memorial for all of their fallen officers, which includes the ones all the way back until the 1800s.
Got it.
So they have that. But that's frustratingly, that's kind of where that ends. All records pertaining to these officers, probably, I mean, I know for a fact any of the 1800 ones and up until at least the 1920s, there's absolutely no records kept by the police department on their deaths or anything. Oh, wow.
Is that because the organized crime had bought off figureheads to sweep it under the rug because of prohibition, or?
I doubt it. I bet you it was just more of a, it doesn't matter, who's going to care? They died, move on. I honestly think the level, everybody never chalk up to malevolence what you can chalk up to stupidity. So I don't think in that era, you're talking about the late 1800s, you look at Wyatt Earp and those, the mm-hmm. days of the lawman, you were going to die. You, the idea of being a lawman and dying early in your career was a very real possibility. Mm-hmm. And it just was a fact of life. So I don't think it was malice. Do you? I think it was just, they didn't think it was important.
Yeah, I don't think it was malice either. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of their current command staff trying to get this information, and they're all super helpful. And of course, you know, if they could make it happen, they would have that information. You know, I think a lot of it was, you know, maybe there was some stuff at the time, and then, you know, flash forward 100 years and they're cleaning out, you know, an old building. It's like, oh, what is this? Let's get rid of it. And so, no, I don't think it was any malice or anything like that. I just think that, you know, over time, unlike some of your agencies, maybe like Boston or L.A. or New York, where history is just such an integral part of their agency, where they may have saved all this information. You know, it was just one of those things where it didn't happen.
And, you know, a lot of even those agencies, you need someone willing to be the archivist, you know, you need somebody that's willing to be the historian. You have to have the guy, you know, LAPD has the police museum, mm-hmm. but you have to be willing to have a guy who's willing to run the museum.
Right.
And if you don't, then they're not going to care.
Yeah. Yeah. So my first thing with this was to go to Atlanta police and say, hey, this is who I am, and this is who my uncle was. What do you have? And it took me about a year, you know, to really make it through everyone, up all the way up to the chief, to confirm, all right, there's no original source information that the police department has, you know, unfortunately.
Oh, wow.
So I was able to really go back and get hundreds of articles in newspapers from 1902. You know, in fact, I know you guys are out in California. I even got a Los Angeles newspaper that talks about the event. So I was able to go out and get hundreds of newspapers.
It made it
across
the country.
Well, here's why. So at first, all I knew was that, you know, my uncle was killed on May 17th of 1902. I start looking more, and all of a sudden I see two other Atlanta police officers killed on May 17th, 1902. And then I see a county officer killed May 17th, 1902. Then I see a bailiff was killed same day. And then I start reading these news articles, and it becomes apparent to me that this was a large deal. And to sum it up, it actually when this gun battle occurred on the morning of May 17th, 1902, it was the largest gun battle the city of Atlanta had seen since the Battle of Atlanta took place in 1864 for the Civil War.
Holy shit.
So, wow. Yeah, so it became a huge thing.
It's like
and
the Atlanta
it was,
OK Corral.
Yeah.
Honestly, it was at the time. So that happened in 1902, and I'll go into detail, but it sparked a lot of racial tension and led up to the 1906 race riots in Atlanta, mm-hmm. which are pretty well known. Mm-hmm. So basically what had happened, and I'm still, you know, going through this to try and find out all the details, but there was a – I'm still trying to confirm whether he was a current Atlanta police officer or had recently retired, but this guy, his name was Officer Curlin. And Officer Curlin was walking basically at the time was right at the western city limits of the city of Atlanta. And the story goes that a guy named Will Richardson, who was a known criminal – and supposedly was someone that Curlin had arrested, recognizes him. And him and Will Richardson and a gang of his buddies attack Curlin. And the police are called, and some of the county guys get dispatched out there. And they chase this Will Richardson guy and his gang, and they chase him just right a few blocks outside of the then city limits in a pretty dangerous neighborhood then and a pretty dangerous neighborhood now. And
does it have a Martin Luther King Boulevard through it?
Lock your doors and roll up your windows.
Wait,
it does.
Question number two. Does it happen to be in the South End?
Southwest End.
Oh, hey! Twofer. All right,
I need a bell. Continue. Ding, 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 ding.
Twofer.
We always joke about this on the show.
MLK is
MLK
always a shit
and
hole.
The South End.
Yeah.
All right, sorry. I got to be fair, though. We're very proud that MLK is from Atlanta, so there's lots of MLK.
But that's the thing.
No, we get it.
We get it. MLK was a great man. It's just a shame that wherever they put an MLK just happens to not be a great neighborhood.
So when I was running calls, you know, St. Francis Medical Center is right on Martin Luther K. Boulevard in South L.A., and some of the worst shootings that we had, we transported across MLK to St. Francis.
A beautiful, wonderful, awesome Christian minister who spoke about peace and equality, and people do the most heinous shit on the street named after.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Anyway, okay.
Sorry.
This gang with Bill Richardson, they barricade themselves in this house right in that community. Like I said, it was a pretty bad community then. It's a pretty bad community now. And from what I can gather, the county police and some of the sheriff's deputies were out basically kind of setting up a perimeter around this guy. And some shots had already been fired, but it wasn't what I would classify as a gun battle. At some point, and of course, you know, if I got this all, you know, detailed down, but sometime in the early morning, this started on the 16th of May, but sometime on the early morning of the 17th of May, 1902, Atlanta police are called out basically to help. You know, it's literally a few blocks outside of the city, but they're called out to help. And that included my uncle and a few other officers. And they get out there and basically set up a perimeter around this house, and the gun battle is on. There are lots and lots of shots fired. I think I have a quote from one of the newspapers that, you know, thousands of rounds were fired.
Wow. And you're talking wheel guns.
We're talking wheel guns and rifles. Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn. And so
I'm going to buy your book right now.
Yeah.
Just give me a couple more years and we'll get it.
All right.
Anyway.
And so, you know, I have in detail, you know, how the majority of these officers died. But my uncle was basically across, you know, just across the street, kind of taking cover in a house, and exchanging shots with this guy and his gang. And he took a round in the face through a window, and he was dead right there, as well as a few other Atlanta police officers. And, you know, it continued after that. And at one point, some of the gang escaped, and one guy was chased down by at this time there was, like, you know, hundreds of angry citizens out surrounding the scene. And, you know, one of the criminals escaped out the back of a house and went to hide in like a pig's pen. And it's described that he was shot so many times he was undescribed. You know, he couldn't tell it was a human. And this was by citizens
back when they had the blues back.
Back when it was a little different. And so the law enforcement set the house on fire that Will Richardson was in, and ultimately stopped that situation by burning him to death. Then
Dorner.
It gets right. It is very similar to that. But unlike that incident and probably any incident you've heard of, local citizenry got the bodies of some of the dead criminals and drug them in the road up to where the city limits were, and kind of, you know, showed off what they had done. You know, we've captured these heinous criminals. Wow.
God bless them.
Captured in air quotes.
So, hey, but you know what? I'm sure it was an effective deterrent.
Yeah. Hashtag bring back public hangings.
Yeah. I'm just saying.
So, you know, that's really down and dirty, the story. And after that, you know, I've been able to go to a local history center here in Atlanta and get some original source of city council meeting minutes that talk about they're, you know, giving money to my uncle's family and the other officers that were killed. And so I'm able to track some stuff going on and some news articles and whatnot for a few years. But after that, the story just stops. You know, no one really knew about it. There's a local Atlanta historian who is kind of the word for Atlanta history. And, he wrote some chapters about it in a book he had, but besides that, you know, nobody knew about it. I mean, you know, my family didn't even know about it. And the crazy thing is my grandfather's dad, would have been alive for this. And, you know, my grandfather said he'd never heard about it. And, you know, one could only imagine that it was just such a, you know, horrible incident.
Yeah.
We didn't talk about it.
Yeah. And honestly, exactly what you're saying, you know, and my grandfather's kind of alluded to that it was just, you know, oh, we didn't talk about it. Right. And so, you know, my uncle that was killed that day, he left behind a young wife. He left behind two young children, and I was able to, it's been a hell of a ride, but I've been able to, track down pretty much where all of these characters are buried. I used some of my detective skills in this and some of my social media skills in this venture and was able to track down the living family of his wife's side. And so, you know, I went and interviewed some of them, and you'll get a kick out of this, but my uncle's daughter, her name was Ruby, and I tracked down her family. And so I sat down with I can't know the lineage now, but it was basically a great-great-granddaughter. And she's talking and she's like, you're talking.
Second, third cousin twice removed or some shit.
Exactly. Like that. Exactly. Right. And I'm talking to her about this and she's like, oh yeah, you're talking about the policeman. I'm like, oh wow. So you know about it. And so they knew about it. They knew it was passed down on that side of the family. And they were able to give me a little bit of history that I didn't have. And I conducted a few interviews of some extended family and got really some cool background, for the book. So doing that, that was my uncle and those officers killed, you know, that day. Well, then I started looking out about 10 years behind that and then 10 years in front of that. So roughly about 1890 to 1910. And, you know, you had these officers that the Atlanta police, you know, recognized and read their names off in the yearly roll call and had their, you know, some badges up on the wall. But that was it. You know, there wasn't anything at their graves. They didn't know where they were buried, what have you. And so I wanted to incorporate their stories into this book. Mm-hmm. And so right now I have roughly about 10 officers that I'm going to basically write a chapter in, you know, for this book. And I'll give you one story, real quick. An officer, around the same time he would have worked with my uncle, his name was Ed Debray, and his parents, his dad was a French nobleman who fled France, and came to Georgia of all places.
And, as one does when fleeing France.
Right.
Random. Why not? Random. Right? Very. But Ed Debray was, at the time, he was described as as kind of like the special operations at the time. And he was a bicycle police officer. So from everything that I've read.
With the first bicycle? He's a high wheeler. He's one of those with the giant front wheel.
Right? So what I've gathered is around the turn of the century, the Atlanta police started to use bicycle patrol. It was breaking technology, and it was pretty high speed stuff around the turn of the century for the Atlanta police. And Ed Debray was one of these, you know, special bike policemen. And he was out again on the west side of town one night, and a guy came up to him and said, "Hey, there's some trouble down this road." And he, you know, Officer DeBray started walking down this road, and it's described that it was towards the towards right coming up to the end of the city limits. And all of a sudden, he's walking down the middle of the road, and three or four guys jump out, and the gunfight's on. So they're assassinating this guy, this officer. He was able to return some fire. He emptied his wheel gun, but he was unfortunately shot and killed and assassinated that night. Yeah. And yeah, and so from some interviews, basically that one guy that flagged him down and kind of led him into the ambush talked and kind of gave the story that it was exactly that. It was assassination and ambush. I've been able to find.
Was he targeted? Was he specifically targeted, or was it just a officer that just happened to be in the area?
From what I can find, and there's some good indication to believe that he was targeted because it was him, because he made some arrests in that area.
Got it.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've been able to find, you know, I found where he's buried, and, you know, he's in an unmarked grave with his family at a very, historical and active cemetery in Atlanta. And it's, you know, I'd love to, you know, eventually raise some money for him. But one of the things that I've also done with all these officers and their stories is I've gone to where it happened. And one of the things that I'm fascinated with is going to a place current day and saying, this happened here X amount of years ago. Mm-hmm. And I've been able to do that with a lot of these,
We got you.
All right. We're back.
Yeah.
Yeah. We lost connection here for a second.
John and I were joking that this has literally been, we thought, one of the best Skype calls we've ever had as far as not having problems. And then just thinking that fucked it up. Don't ever say the night when you're on patrol. Don't ever say it's slow. Yeah. Don't ever say it's slow.
Don't ever say
when you're on Skype. Keyword. Don't ever say it's a good connection.
we have all learned the not to say it's slow, quiet, or you're bored. On patrol.
Exactly. All right. Anyway, so you went to the. So I'm going to say this. I'm going to put this out there for you. You go to Ed's cemetery plot, and it's unmarked. If you decide at some point that you want to start raising money to get some of these markers going, let us know, and we'll mm-hmm. reach out to our listeners and see if we can't, you know, get people to try and donate to get the marker put there for whoever you need to have it put there for. Yeah. So.
That is that's amazing. I really appreciate that, and as you know those officers, with knowing that option is out there, is something they would appreciate too. So that's really great.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe one person doesn't, one or two people doesn't have to absorb the cost. Let's just have, you know, 100 or 200 people.
Yeah, when the time comes, for sure. We'll,
let us know,
and we'll set something up.
Cool. That's awesome. So, you know, I say all that to say that, you know, that has turned into a few years endeavor, you know, with my assignment at the police department. You know, I work a lot of overtime, after hours, non-conventional stuff. So, you know, I go through spurts where I'm pretty hardcore into the research and the history and writing. And then, you know, I'll go months where I don't touch it, you know, because, you know, you got to put food on the table. Sure. But, you know, my goal is in, you know, honestly, you know, maybe in a year or two have something together and be able to put it out. And I've done a little bit of work with, you know, ODMP and the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Association. So I'm hoping that, you know, that any money from that will go straight to them. But, you know, once I can get it up and running, you know, I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah. Nice. Well, so quick question. What did I'm assuming it was your great, great uncle or your great uncle. That is that you're talking about? What did that shithead do? Why did he decide? I mean,
yeah. So it's all right. So I've spent, you know, hundreds of hours, you know, reading turn of the century newspapers, and so this is no opinion, just factual based on what was being written at the time. But if you were a African-American citizen, especially a criminal, there was not a lot of information kept on you. You know, that's just how it was for turn of the century. So this guy, Will Richardson, that shot all these officers that day, I'm able to track him back to his early teenage years on some census records that put him in a, I don't want to, maybe kind of like a work camp at one point, you know, indicating that he was in some trouble then. You know, he, on some of the censuses that I locate him in, he's in, you know, bad parts of town. So one can imagine that he was, you know, involved in some criminal activity. A couple, accounts have described him as being in gangs. So, you know, one can imagine that he was just, you know, involved in
a frequent flyer.
So
as far as the incident involving your uncle, there isn't a clear consensus as to what was the catalyst, what this guy did that lit the match that sparked the blaze that caused the shootout.
I feel pretty confident in saying that what lit that, you know, that sparked that flame that night and started that shootout was an interaction with that officer Curlin and Will Richardson and his gang. You know, what was before that, you know, I got some ideas and maybe some avenues to try and figure it out, but I'm pretty confident in saying that what sparked that night was from some interaction that was had between Will Richardson and his gang and that officer.
Okay. So something bad went down. They wanted to hook him up for something and they said no.
Pretty much.
No.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And it's a real cool story that I found, but one of the officers, Atlanta police officers that was dispatched to the incident, his name was Tom Grant. And there's a story about how apparently Officer Grant, I guess, was at police headquarters as that was going on and had started to unload his duty gear, which really consisted of a wheel gun and a wooden baton. But apparently he placed his wooden baton on top of a piece of furniture or something in the precinct, got the call, and then just left without grabbing it. And so the officers talk about how they get back to headquarters after, you know, four or five of these officers have died and see Officer Grant's, you know, baton just sitting there. And it's a pretty haunting, you know, news article that, you know, I think stays true, you know, whether it's military or law enforcement in current day about how, you know, things like that can really haunt you.
You know, yeah. It's interesting that there are, I mean, despite the fact that it's wheel guns, it's, you know, the turn of the century, it's, you know, there's so many differences as far as the minutia goes, but the fundamentals, the ambush of a bicycle cop who had made some unpopular arrests and the locals decided they were going to murk him. Mm-hmm. This other, your uncle, where, you know, him and a bunch of cops decide they need to arrest somebody who is involved in a criminal organization, whether it's a street gang or something more significant. And they decide, no, I don't want to be arrested today. And I'm willing to kill anybody who wants to make that happen. Those themes are still the same,
right?
Those are still watching out for being ambushed, you know, watching out for the guy that says, you know what? Not today. I'm not going to jail today. And they're willing to do anything so they don't have to go to jail that day. Mm-hmm. Your uncle didn't know that, ostensibly, your uncle may not have known that that's what that day held for him when he put on his badge and went to work.
Right.
The things that we have faced over the hundreds and hundreds of years since, you know, Robert Peel pioneered civilian police forces haven't really changed.
No.
Running out of the station and forgetting a piece of equipment.
I was just about to say that.
Right?
Has not changed.
Yeah. I've run out of the station and gone, ah, shit. You know, I stopped putting my gun in the locker at the jail very early on because I had an FTO who said, no, you put it in the trunk, son. Mm-hmm. I said, why? He goes, because the first time you got to run to a hot call out of the jail, you're going to forget your gun.
Yep.
And, you know,
it's
interesting that all of those things are the same. The guns have changed, the drugs have changed, but not the motivations, not the human heart, not what causes all that
the
shit.
The human tendencies.
Yeah.
People are evil.
True.
So
yeah, and like I said, you know, I've gone through hundreds of articles and you know, writings from police in that time frame, and like you said, it really does. One of the things I realized from all that is, you know, not too much has changed. Of course, the equipment and the technology and what have you. But yeah, when it comes down to it, you know, bad guys, good guys. I mean, yeah, it's still very much the same.
Yeah. Cops want to catch bad guys. Bad guys don't want to be caught, and firemen will stage. That's.
So you get a little kid dressed up as a cop and a little kid dressed up as a firefighter coming up to your door for Halloween, right?
Right.
So you tell the little kid dressed up as a firefighter to fuck off until the cop clears the scene and he gets his candy, and then the little firefighter can come up and get his. Yeah.
The little kid dressed as a fireman has to make sure the front porch is safe before the little kid dressed as a firefighter can come get candy. Oh, it's firefighters and cops, man. We are not on the same team, but we are all on the same side, and they know we love them, especially when they take somebody off of our hands.
Right. So now I will say with that, the girl I'm dating, for a while she worked for a Department of Public Safety, so she was a cop and a fireman.
Yeah, we talked to another gal from a guy from the South who was on that same kind of a department.
It's a weird thing, you know. It's a weird thing, you know. Like the law enforcement patrol function is the primary focus, but then you know the turnout gear is in the back, and you know we're talking on the phone. She's like, "Hey, I gotta go. I got a structure fire." I'm like, "Well, I thought you were a cop."
Yeah, you're like, "Fuck that."
But in California, because that's so rare, when a cop shows up to a fire and the fire department's not there yet, if you grab your fire extinguisher or you grab the hose and you put it out and there's no actual flames when the fire department gets there, they're pissed. I put out a fire once and they got there. They're like, "What did you do?" I'm like,
"Yeah,
it was small. It was just
because they're legit pyros and." They never get the fire, and when they get the fire, they lose their minds.
Well, I know, but here's the thing. If there was an ass whooping to be had, and the fire department handed out the ass whooping before the cops get there, I'd be pissed.
Yeah, that's true.
I'd be so to my fire guys, I apologize. I apologize for taking your fun away.
I had a fire captain tell me once, he pulled me aside after a structure fire, and he looks at me, and he says, "You know the only difference between a pyro and a fireman?" I said, "What?" And he says, "A fucking badge."
Oh, wow.
That's probably right.
That's probably true.
Probably right.
Yeah, I don't want to be a fireman, but no. I'm not a pyro. No. True. So, we normally... go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was going to say my grandfather, my mom's dad, who was a fireman, I guess with 50s, 60s, and 70s in rural South Georgia, he would make the joke that the way you find the difference, or the way that you find a cop and a fireman, is you put them in a big hole. Don't ask how they get down there. But the ones that climb up the ladder and out are the firemen, and the ones that stay at the bottom are the policemen.
I mean, he's not wrong.
No.
Right?
No. He's not wrong. No. I mean, here's the thing. If I was smart enough to know that we would get paid for sleeping on duty, I'd have gotten into the other line at the academy, and I wasn't. So, I mean, let's face
done it. Done it that way.
If cops and firemen were smarter, we'd be lawyers, but...
True.
So I think we normally open up the dedication of the episode to the guest, and I think this kind of writes itself, man. I can only imagine we would dedicate this to your great uncle.
Yeah. So, Ed Crabtree, my great uncle, there was a officer named Ed Battle, Hugh Osborne, and Thomas Grant. They were all officers that were killed that day, in 1902. And then, I'll also dedicate it to, Ed DeBray. Even though he wasn't killed in that incident, he's the only one that I've written a full chapter on, and he's kind of got a special place in my heart. So we'll tip it off to all of them.
Yeah, especially for being the first bicycle cop in the universe to get first bicycle cop period, and then to get ambushed. You know,
right?
That's wild.
That's rough. Straight up, like, we're looking forward to this book.
Yeah.
Whether it takes you a year or two, whatever, we're looking forward to this.
Yeah, for sure.
Hurry the hell up.
We'll have you back. We'll have you back on anytime you have a story you want to share. But for sure, when you get the book finished and you're getting ready to publish it and stuff like that, we got to come back on and talk about it.
Yeah.
So.
Cool. So what I'll do is I'll actually send you guys, I kind of have like a 4 or 5 paragraph summary of the book, and then I have the chapter on Ed DeBray. So I'll send that over to you guys for you to read.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. Great. Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, did you have any thoughts or anything you wanted to say, any closing words?
No, one thing I'm going to do is, I love the podcast. I love what you guys are about. You know, your intro, to the podcast is so true. I really love that, and then what it says. I don't have some crazy following on social media, but I'm definitely gonna share you guys, because I think that both people who are currently in public safety and then people who are thinking about getting in it can get a lot out of podcasts like this. So I think what you guys are doing, like, it's fun, obviously, but I think even on a deeper level, it's helping a lot of folks out.
Well, we appreciate it. We started off just because we thought it was fun, and we hoped it would have an impact. It's had way more of an impact than we possibly imagined.
Definitely more than I thought it was.
I mean, even though it was for fun and it was to give people a straight up look on our side of the story, it's definitely impacted a lot more people than we realized, and more so the people that are not even necessarily directly involved in this line of work. It's more like the families members and people that just know people in law enforcement or the military or paramedics or you know things like that.
I still go back to the day we sat down and recorded our first episode with and it was me, John, and Elliot, and Elliot says, yeah, who wants to listen to this shit?
I know, he did say that.
And I said, I think people do.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know, maybe people will think this is cool. That's cool. Fuck it.
Wow. So, yeah. We definitely appreciate you coming on. We appreciate you. And JR, thank you for, you know, giving this Lauren to us. And again, always hit us up. And, John, if you want to book yourself on the show, contact John. It doesn't matter if you're a public servant, you know, police, fire, mm-hmm. paramedic, EMT, you know, military veteran, active, you know, retired, you know, you saw time in Desert Storm 1 or Vietnam,
or even a story like this with, you know, someone that was related to you far down the line. I mean, this is very, very interesting things. And I think it's important that we do hear stories about people that you just don't hear about anymore. So I think that's great.
You have to honor that legacy as well. And the learning you take away from it, like we were talking about, is that it hasn't changed.
No.
Like, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. You should, the problems are still the problems. Mm-hmm.
And who knew a specialized unit was on a bike?
Yeah.
Back then. That's
1902
crazy.
Bicycle Patrol.
That's crazy.
That's got to be a record. That's got to be a record.
I find that very interesting. Yeah. I think that's
cool. Got to be a record.
Yeah. I'm thinking of two articles off the top of my head that the Atlanta newspapers covered that talked about just how groundbreaking it was to be patrolling on a bicycle.
Yeah.
That's wild.
I mean, they're effective. I wouldn't want to wear the shorts, but they're effective.
They're effective.
So,
well, I did bike patrol for a little while, and it was one of the funnest assignments I had.
Yeah. If it was at the beach, I'm in.
But I did it too.
Bike patrol anywhere other than the beach,
I did it in South Central, and that was fun.
Wow.
I did that, and it was fun.
Wow.
It was so much fun. Because
you don't even get to stare at ass on the beach.
Yeah, I know, but you know what? You get to go places where cars can't.
That's
and
true.
That's okay. where everyone's
that's
at.
That's the thing. As much as you can make fun, it is a really effective mode mm-hmm. of transportation in some of those areas.
And then also, when you get to ghost ride your fucking bike into somebody, come on.
Hey, so I got if I can, I'd like to read one paragraph of this intro to the book that I think sums it up really well.
Go for it.
All right, okay. So after the smoke had settled, at least 3,000 shots had been fired and 4 cops lay dead. 3 citizens were killed, 6 people were wounded, and nearly 5,000 white armed citizens were rioting. The incident would become the deadliest shootout in Atlanta since July of 1864, when the armies under General John Bell Hood and General William T. Sherman met on the battlefield of Ezra Church. Ironically enough, C.E., who's my uncle, his father and my great-great-great-grandfather fought and survived that battle at Ezra Church. The Pittsburgh riots, as this bloody incident would become known, would be forever nailed into the memory of the city of Atlanta.
Wow. I like it.
Yeah.
Holy that shit.
Sums it up.
Yeah, pretty much. Wow. Get on this book.
Yeah,
let's go.
Yeah. I'm read it. I'm almost done with my book. Can you finish it before I'm done with the book I'm reading?
Right. But thank you guys for letting me come on and you know, tell these brave officers' story, and it's been a pleasure.
We appreciate it. John, do you have anything?
No, I'm good. You know, you have my number now, so please hit me up if you ever need anything on this end. Or if you have any questions of us, or you want to come back on, please hit me up.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
James?
Yeah, very cool.
All good, my man. It was good meeting you, brother. Find me on the gram.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah, how can people reach us? Sure. How can people reach us, John?
Hit us up on Instagram at War Stories Official, Facebook at War Stories Official. Pretty much put in War Stories Official on any type of social media.
We're working on some hats and patches.
Yeah, you'll find us. We were just talking about hats today. We're going to keep it simple. Hope you guys like FlexFit, because that's the route we're going.
And we may have found a workaround because we were at a roadblock with this stupid quarantining thing to getting our sweatshirts and t-shirts done. So stand by for updates, because I may have found a workaround where we can get them done.
Nice.
At this point, we all thought we'd be back.
Yeah, and you guys keep reminding us, like, hey, like, you ordered this, or hey, I was interested in this. Like, we get it, and we completely understand it. We're doing our best to get this stuff out.
Especially because right now it's tough to get anything, so... well, thank you for coming on, man. And until our next episode, come home with your shield or honor.